Devoncast
from Radio X.
Welcome to Devoncast, your weekly helping of the big stories in local politics from across our wonderful county. Devoncast is brought to you by Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. My name is Alison Stevenson, and today I'm joined by my colleague Guy Henderson, who's been in the presence of the Police and Crime Commissioner Alison Hernandez down there in Torquay. I hope you didn't get too wet, Guy.
It was extremely wet, Ali. It was absolutely pouring down with rain. It was almost a Rishi Sunak moment for Alison Hernandez. She was out there talking to the cameras in the absolutely torrential downpour. So, it was a little damp, shall we say.
Oh dear, we've had a few of those lately, haven't we? Not nice. We got a lovely sunny day today, so that's good news.
Indeed.
Well, with devolution and local government reorganisation affecting all aspects of political life here in Devon, Guy gets a lowdown on what the Commissioner makes of it all and how it might impact her role.
And sadly, our reporter colleague Bradley Gerrard is poorly this week, so he won't be contributing to the podcast today. We hope he's feeling better soon and will be rapidly back in action. We've got more on the large development at Water Lane in Exeter, which will bring a brownfield site back into use with homes, leisure and retail facilities, workspaces and public recreational areas. And we have a special interview with Jana Sanders, the manager of the Business Improvement District, or BID, in Tavistock, who's holding the fort at Oakhampton 2 for the next few months while a new BID there gets off the ground. And we find out what's in store for the West Devon market town and what's made the Tavistock BID a success since it was created there 14 years ago.
But we start off in Plymouth, where amongst all the talk of devolution and a complete overhaul of local government, which has dominated Devoncast over the past few weeks, a local campaign group pushing for a directly elected mayor for the city, chosen by the people rather than a political party, looks like it will get its wish for a referendum. The group, Yes Devon Plymouth, has submitted a petition of more than 13,000 names requesting a referendum so the public can decide whether or not they want a directly elected mayor who would replace the leader of the council. Residents didn't want it in 2002 when the last referendum on the subject was held, at a time when elected mayors were very much favoured by the government, as they are now. At that time, 59% of people who voted in the city said no, but it's firmly back on the agenda. In order to trigger a referendum, the Local Government Act 2000 says 5% of the electorate have to want it, and the Yes Dem Plymouth campaign has exceeded that by more than 3,000 signatures. Under the current system, the council leader is selected by the ruling party in Plymouth, who then appoints an executive cabinet from his or her party of up to 9 members, who make policy decisions which then have to go to the full council for approval. It's the view of the Yes Dem Plymouth campaign that the current system is too political, fractious and without clear 4-year objectives, sees a cabinet selected purely on political grounds and with too much power residing with senior non-elected officers. They see the alternative model as a way of attracting talented people to local government who would never consider standing as a councillor normally and believe that it puts people and place above politics.
In reality, though, many directly elected mayors in England are already politicians and have stood under a party banner. For example, Andy Burnham, who was the Labour MP for Lee before he became Mayor of Greater Manchester, and Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London, who was a Labour Member of Parliament for Tooting previously. According to Plymouth City Council on their website, a directly elected mayor has the same powers as a council leader, but they can choose executive members from any of the council's elected membership, rather than based on a political party. We asked the man behind Yes Dem Plymouth, Angus Forbes, who's a former banker, environmentalist and speaker, and whose wife is ballerina and former Strictly Come Dancing judge Darcy Bustle, for an interview, but he declined at this time. Meanwhile, this is what council leader Tudor Evans had to say in the chamber this week when asked how much a referendum, election and post of mayor would cost.
The petition for a directly elected mayor has been submitted to the council, but I'm not in a position at the moment to say when the referendum will be held. It has to be held within 6 months of a valid petition being submitted, which means, of course, that means it won't be held in May 2026 on the date that the next set of elections in Plymouth will be held. That means, therefore, that a whole full city operation has to be put into place in order to have a referendum, which means on the current wards, there'll be a polling station, polling staff, counters, and all the usual paraphernalia of holding a valid count. Officers have indicated to me that the cost of that would be some £410,000 to hold a standalone referendum in the summer. On top of that, there would need to be an election. If it was successful, there would need to be an election to be held in May next year for this directly elected mayor. That, in fact, that would coincide with an election for 19 of the 20 Plymouth wards. But in order for it to be a valid mayoral election, the all 20 wards would need to have be set up. The additional cost for providing the polling stations, the counting staff, and doing the mayoral count has been estimated at this point at £80,000. So we're actually talking getting on for £500,000 just to run it, and then that is without the mayor itself, who has a salary, has staff. I mean, Patrick Nicholson and myself will recall we estimated back 15, 20 years ago when there was an effort like this, that the cost of a mayor at that point would have been £1 million a year in wages plus their staffing costs. That's in addition to what the council itself, which would continue to operate with 57 of us, but it would have an additional layer. So the other important thing to say, that the cost of the mayoralty is not out of a precept. In other words, it won't be an additional council tax, but what it will do is have to come out of existing budgets. So in the budget meeting in February, we will have to make an adjustment for £500,000 to cover this referendum plus the election if it's successful. That's out of services or out of balances. And bear in mind, scrutiny told us last week that they wanted to see balances increased. They can't be if the money comes out of balances. But the following year, the cost of the mayor and their office would have to come off services. So that'd be £1 million, maybe £1.5 million of cuts to services to pay for a mayor. The all idea that this would result in more money for Plymouth is a fallacy, because what would happen is there's no more money for a directly elected mayor for Plymouth and no more power. What there is having to top slice what is currently coming in order to pay the piper, to pay the mayor.
That was leader of Plymouth City Council, Tudor Evans. Prior to the 2002 referendum, both the Labour and Conservative groups on Plymouth City Council campaigned against having a directly elected mayor. So we've heard a lot about elected mayors recently in the government's white paper on devolution, and there could be a large strategic authority covering Devon, Cornwall, Plymouth and Torbay in the future, led by a directly elected mayor, if that's the way the government wants it to go. Leader of the Conservative group at Plymouth City Council, Councillor Andy Lugger, shared his thoughts on the idea of Plymouth getting a directly elected mayor. He said when we asked him, compounded by the direction of travel for a mayoral strategic authority, another mayor is just a nonsense, he said. Moreover, we will be embarking on local government restructuring, so this authority will be very different once reform happens. If this referendum is successful, the earliest unelected local mayor elections will take place in 2026. The local authority might not be the same political area then. How does this affect the legality of the referendum, he is asking. He said that he agrees with the leader's comments at full council that a local elected mayor will cost the people of Plymouth dear. Not only will there be the cost of the election, but the running cost of a completely new mayoral department that will come straight out of council's strained budget. To my mind, this is a bridge too far, he says. So, directly elected mayors. Guy, what's your opinion on those?
Well, this can be quite divisive. I mean, Andy Lugger's comments are interesting there. He's the leader of the Conservative group at the City Council, isn't he? Interesting comments. We've had elected mayors in the past in Torbay. We had elected mayors between 2005 and 2019. Quite a long time, actually. Nick Bye to begin with, and then Gordon Oliver. People then voted for a return to a council leader system, which is what we have at the moment. But you have to have a big character to be an elected mayor. We had to. I was talking to Nick Bye this week, strangely enough, as we were sheltering from the rain yesterday. And we talked about his time as elected mayor. He had a thing called the Mayor's Vision, which people in Torbay will remember. It was a document that he brought out, which was his vision for lots of places across Torbay for developments for the future. And as he was pointing out yesterday, quite a lot of the things in his Mayor's Vision are finally coming to fruition now, long after, he came out of office 14 years ago nearly. But his mayor's vision is still in the background. So interesting. You're really opening up a whole new structure of government that people won't be used to.
Yeah, I mean it is quite different, isn't it? Because according to Plymouth City Council, they're saying that the role is no different from a council leader. But I mean, if you look at the salary difference, that's quite a big salary difference.
It's probably quite hefty.
It is really well. The council leader at the moment is on about 50,000. Now, directly elected mayors can get a lot more than that. I mean, they're talking there. Tudor there's talking up to £1 million, or more than £1 million, possibly for the office. What they do extra, that's something that I'd really like to find out more. So I'm trying to find out more at the moment. But it's definitely interesting. But I think it's getting quite confusing for people because we keep talking about different strategic authorities and different mayors of different areas. And I think at the moment, maybe it's not the right time. I don't know. The people will decide, but it's all up in the air, isn't it, at the moment? So.
That's true. Funnily enough, another person I was talking to yesterday, who is the ex-MP for Torbay, Kevin Foster, was saying that it's interesting with this whole debate about reorganisation and the possible creation of these huge strategic authorities. Kevin pointed out that at the council meeting in Torbay that discussed the whole thing, there were only three non-councillors there. There was him, there was one member of the public, and there was me. So it hasn't exactly caught the public's imagination. People won't even notice. It'll just be a lot of bureaucratic name changing until changes are made in how and when they get their bins emptied, changes are made in housing policy, and the green fields on the edge of their village or whatever suddenly
Yeah,
become part of a housing strategy.
absolutely. And whether they can get hold of their local councillor or not. So we'll just have to wait and see, won't we? But
We
plenty to
will.
talk about for us for a while. But what have we got next, Guy?
Well, you're listening to Devoncast, which is available from your regular podcast provider and on Devoncast Radio across the county. We'll talk a little bit more about devolution later. But for the time being, last week on Devoncast, we promised to keep you up to date with the Water Lane development in Exeter. Even if you only go into Exeter once in a blue moon, you'll notice this when it gets developed. 900 new homes and hundreds of units of purpose-built student accommodation. That's much easier to write than it is to say. Right on the banks of the canal on a site that's crying out for development, but it has to be done right. And councillors have been raising concerns about how tall the blocks will be, how resilient the site is to flooding, and how access will be maintained to Gabriel's Wharf. That's the point where heavy cranes can access the canal to lift boats in and out, and where a crane came in the other day to move the hulk of the old fishing boat Marie Claire, which I wrote a piece about the other day. Interesting background to that old wreck that was alongside. The main concern, though, was over affordable housing. Exeter City Council has a policy that 35% of homes in any new development should be in the affordable bracket. But there's a mechanism where an independent arbiter can say that the figure just isn't viable on a certain scheme, so should be waived. And that's what's happened here. Although the council and the developer both say this will be reviewed regularly during the build, so there might be some scope for some affordable housing. Anyway, taking the recording of the debate, here's Planning Committee Chairman, Labour Councillor Paul Knott, setting the scene.
Is possibly the largest and most complex application that we've had before, certainly in my time here, and I understand going back some 17 or 18 years.
That was the opening of a meeting that lasted almost 4 hours and during which almost every member of the committee chipped in. Here's Green Councillor Diana Moore raising the issue of the affordable housing, an SPD, which she mentions, by the way, is a supplementary planning document.
We're talking about a long-term project here, 10 years or so. What's unviable today may be profitable tomorrow. And I would urge you to stick to the council's principles. We can't take a fingers crossed approach. This site is described in the SPD as Exeter's quality flagship development. Without affordable housing, that claim is sunk, and our community is denied the affordable and social housing that is desperately needed. On the whole, the majority of the community want to see Water Lane developed, and they want to see it developed well. This isn't just any development. It will be one of Exeter City Council's defining legacies. We mustn't compromise on livable Exeter's stated values and the needs of our people. The future of our city does literally hang in the balance here. And let's tip the scales towards progress and craft a truly inclusive, sustainable community that will make Exeter shine.
Conservative councillor Anne Jobson said she also had concerns over what the development would bring for people desperate for local homes.
There should be a clear commitment within the papers that Exeter City Council is committed to providing affordable and social housing. And we acknowledge the difficulties of a brownfield development, but we are committed to reviewing the element of affordable or social housing at each and every review. It means it is there in black and white. It shows the residents of Exeter that we are concerned about the fact that nobody on the housing waiting list will be able to move into one of these Water Lane places as it currently stands, and that's contrary to Exeter's commitments.
Representing the Water Lane Development Management Company, Andy Wilkins reassured councillors that affordable housing will be reviewed regularly and said he was eager to get cracking.
This evening will hopefully provide a watershed moment for the city that will see the delivery wheels start to move to deliver much needed housing on what is a sustainable, allocated brownfield site within the Water Lane regeneration area. This site is about as brown as a brownfield site can get, and the cost for delivery is significant. The site assembly is complex and very costly. It comprises an old contaminated industrial site, including the once noxious meat rendering facility. We understand that affordable housing provision is a critical issue. This is more straightforward to deliver on greenfield sites, but less so on sites of this complexity. The affordable market is particularly fragile at the moment, even on greenfield sites, owing to a lack of available funding. This market will change and will in turn assist with the provision of affordable homes on this site. Nothing's off the table, and the review mechanism facilitates this process. This is an exciting moment that will see the delivery of much needed homes in a truly sustainable manner. I would urge you to allow us to take the next steps together and to help deliver the exemplar regeneration scheme that is proposed.
And here's Paul Knott again, summing up just before a vote that went unanimously in favour of the development going ahead.
This is an extraordinarily challenging and profoundly difficult site to develop. And so there are several mitigating reasons why we have to accept the lack of an immediate amount of affordable housing. I'm satisfied that these conditions in place reassure that the should the development viability allow affordable housing, it will be delivered.
Next, we go to West Devon, where I caught up with Janice Sanders, who's helping to steer the new Business Improvement District, or BID, in Okehampton. The initiative, which raises money to help boost business and the economy, has been tested out and running for a number of years in cities like Exeter and Plymouth and market towns like Tavistock. Jana has been the manager of the Tavistock BID for nearly a decade, and in this interview she explains more about what a BID is, what's in store for Okehampton, and the success of the Tavistock scheme. She will be holding the fort as manager at Okehampton until a permanent post is filled.
A BID is a very specific geographic location within a town in which the businesses vote for or against the BID. The BID is an organisation that essentially works on behalf of those businesses. Those businesses pay into a pot. It's their levy payment, that's what it's called. And that pot of money is then spent on projects within the town centre to benefit those businesses within it.
So it's all about town enhancement, isn't it? And raising the footfall in the town so you can boost the economy. And there's been a lot of success in Tavistock over the years because the business community have voted for it three or four times now.
It's three times now. We're going into our fourth ballot.
Yeah, OK. So we'll hear about that a bit more in a moment. But tell me what the plans are for Okehampton.
Well, so Campton's in a great position at the moment. There's the new funding for the new railway on the edge of town. Obviously, the Dartmoor line has come back in, and that's bringing great numbers of visitors into the town. Okehampton has an enviable location. It's right on the edge of Dartmoor. It's got some great things to explore in the town, the castle, the Museum of Dartmoor Life, Simmons Park. So it's got some really, really great things about it. And the bid coming into fruition now at this particular point in time can only be a really good thing for the town. It can bring together all the businesses and the community groups so that everybody can work together to make Okehampton the place that people want to come and visit.
In the past, Okehampton struggled a little bit with bringing people together. I know that the Chamber disbanded many years ago, and they've tried to bring a bid in before in 2013, I believe. What's changed now?
I think businesses now can see, well, can hopefully see the benefit that a bid brings. You know, they can look at Tavistock and other neighbouring towns and cities that have bids and understand that actually the bid is a voice for them. So Okehampton benefits from some great community groups. And I guess the bid can sort of be an overarching organisation above those to bring everybody together. And so I'm guessing, you know, Tavistock Bid especially did a lot of great work during COVID. And I know that some Okehampton businesses were in touch with me during that time. So it's possibly a combination of the sort of fallout of COVID and the need for some voice that is there specifically for businesses. And also just seeing how Okehampton's changing and all the great things that are happening have made people think that this is a really good thing to have in place now.
There were 65% of businesses who voted in favour of the bid area. Would you have preferred more?
Yeah, I think obviously everybody would prefer more, but I think for a first ballot, that's a really impressive vote. Obviously, you're not going to have everybody on side, and I think the bid, as it sort of comes into place, you know, nothing's going to happen immediately. It takes time to put everything in place. But hopefully those businesses who probably couldn't see the benefits will gradually see that actually the bid is a good force for change, and that it's good to engage with it and be part of it so that everybody can work together for the good of the town.
There's 270 businesses within this bid area. Will all those businesses have to pay that levy?
So the 270 that you mentioned do have to pay. There will be some who have fallen outside of the payment requirements. So any business whose rateable value falls below £4,999 doesn't have to pay, but they are still within the bid area, and so they will therefore naturally still benefit from the activities of the bid. They just don't pay into it and therefore do not have a voice or a vote at things like the AGM and stuff like that, and can't be part of all of those voting procedures. But essentially every business within that district will benefit in some way or another from the bid.
Okehampton itself, it's grown quite a lot. It now has some quite big businesses there. Have they been the driver for this?
So, yeah, it's astonishing to see how many big, great businesses there are in Okehampton. I think predominantly these bigger businesses have been in favour of the bid. Obviously, some of them might be national businesses who see how bids work elsewhere and therefore believe that it's a good thing for Okehampton too. So, yes, I think these businesses who are on the periphery see that if Okehampton, the town, is thriving, that benefits the people that work for them, that benefits their business on a bigger picture. So, yeah, they have been very supportive generally of this.
It's quite a hard time for high streets, isn't it? I mean, they have to compete with the bigger towns and cities. And a lot of businesses have closed, haven't they, in some market towns. It must be quite a challenge to get people to come back to the high street.
It's a huge challenge. And I know that, you know, going into this year, a lot of businesses in our towns in West Devon are really worried. I've been on a few webinars recently about high street economies, and the market town kind of vibe is bouncing back a little bit. So there is a renewed enthusiasm for the market town and for shopping locally and that kind of thing, which is obviously great. But it is really difficult to do business on the high street. But in Okehampton, there are relatively few vacant properties. There's been a Budgens that's just come into one of the bigger stores on the high street. And Okehampton really does have a lot to offer. It's got some great independent shops. So one of the priorities of the bid is to really sing about this and to let people know that, you know, these are some of the reasons to come into Okehampton. It's not just about Dartmoor or the castle, or, you know, there are some great independent shops and a high street worth visiting.
I think sometimes Okehampton has felt like the poor relation to Tavistock, though. Do you ever hear that?
Yeah, we hear that all the time. But I, you know, genuinely, I've spent a lot of time in Okehampton recently, and I don't really see that as the case. You know, the two offerings are very different, really. You know, Okehampton has more of a rural charm probably about it. You know, its proximity to the moor, and it is a very different town to Tavistock. You know, the castle itself, what a great thing to have. So I, you know, yes, we hear that all the time, but this is something that the bid is there to do. It's to kind of actually say, well, hang on a minute, this is what Okehampton has to offer, and this is why you need to come.
In Tavistock itself, then, I mean, the bid's been going for an awfully long time, and I'm guessing that, you know, some people have seen how successful it is there and thought, well, maybe we should jump on board in Okehampton because of that. Tell me what's happened in Tavistock over those years, since 2011, that's been instrumental in terms of what bid has done.
So I think the bid in Tavistock, you know, it has gained support. I think it sort of has been a bit up and down over the years, but latterly support is good for the bid. We have done some really great things, you know, so we've taken over the town marketing, so the Visit Tavistock brand is managed by Tavistock Bid. It's the only official voice of the town, so we do a lot, we invest quite a lot of our bid levy into marketing the town. We also do great things. We've taken over Dickensian Evening, and that has grown enormously. We now have 10 to 15,000 people come into town for Dickensian Evening. So that's our flagship event, really. We do lots of other events throughout the year. We've started celebrating our cream tea status as the home of the cream tea with a new cream tea festival. So we do all we can to sort of, you know, put Tavistock on the map and make sure people see it as a place that they need to visit when they're in the area.
And how much money has been brought into Tavistock over those years through the bid?
We think that Tavistock's brought in and around the £1 million mark to the benefit of the businesses, which is phenomenal for a small town like Tavistock. You know, and we actually only bring in about £80,000 a year, which isn't a lot of money, but we punch above our weight in terms of what we actually deliver for businesses for that £80,000. And we're constantly looking for additional funding. During COVID, we managed to bring in another £80,000 in one financial year. So that literally doubled the bid levy for that year. So we really do work very hard with the money that we get in for the benefit of the businesses.
And you've also got involved in a few more media topics, haven't you? I mean, let's talk about the Stop the Meters campaign. I mean, that was Tavistock leading the way, wasn't it, when it came to campaigning against parking meters coming into some Devon towns, 8 Devon towns, I believe. How did you get involved in that?
Well, this is something we're really proud of. And fundamentally, this is why a bid exists, to champion the businesses, to be their voice and to say, no, hang on a minute, that's not going to work for us. So, you know, we were approached by Devon County Council with these proposals to put parking meters on the streets of Tavistock and, like you say, 7 other towns in the region. And, you know, it would have fundamentally changed the way people used the high street. The high street, as we've discussed, is already in a sort of a difficult position with people choosing to shop online. This would have just been another reason for people not to come into town. People have been parking on the street for free in Tavistock forever. To suddenly ask them to start paying for it would have just been, you know, an outrage, really. So we teamed up with some strong voices within the town. So from town, we had a few town councillors on board, and West Devon Borough Council, and we created this campaign, Stop the Meters, and we took it to County Hall, and we made sure they absolutely understood that we didn't want this, that the businesses didn't want this, that the people of Tavistock didn't want this, and thankfully they listened, so hugely proud of that one. We're also fundamental in the fight against the proposals for the Premier Inn, you know, a few years before that, because nobody wanted that. And so, yes, I think that is exactly why we're here and what we need to do.
Why did nobody want it?
I think because well, it would have been the loss of a car park, which, you know, obviously then harms footfall, because in the summer months, parking in Tavistock can be tricky, let's say. You know, we do need more parking in those months. So to remove an entire car park was one of the problems. But also, I think businesses were just up in arms with the way that it was kind of being proposed, really. We have a lot of great accommodation already in the town. Was it something that was needed? That was one of the questions. So rightly or wrongly, you know, the businesses asked us to be their voice, and that's what we did.
The newspaper headlines at the time, there were some saying Tavistock was the angriest town in Britain. I mean, Tavistock isn't known for being angry, so that was quite a shocker, wasn't it?
Well, I think that was on the back of the fact that we've also kicked McDonald's out. So I think we do have a reputation as being possibly a bit strong-minded. But, you know, there's nothing wrong in that, you know. And you know, if we get that headline, then it's news, isn't it? And people will go, oh, maybe we need to go and see all these angry people in Tavistock. We're not angry, but, you know.
Right. So when it comes to some of the, perhaps some things that have gone a bit wrong, not necessarily wrong, but when we look at Dickensian last year, there was really nothing you could do about this. It was completely out of your hands because the weather put the kibosh on Dickensian Evening in Tavistock last year. Now, what sort of impact did that have?
Well, so hugely disappointing because, as I said, it's our flagship event and the businesses, you know, absolutely love Dickensian Evening. It's really important for a lot of them. It's the only time the town itself is actually completely pedestrianised. So businesses from one end to the other all benefit from the footfall during Dickensian. So obviously hugely disappointing. Interestingly, though, people really did still come out despite the weather warnings. Yeah. And a lot of shops actually said we had a brilliant evening. You know, yeah. People came out, they actually came out to shop. So, you know, the question now is kind of, where do we go with Dickensian Evening? Because it's become such a big event that people are actually coming for the entertainment more than they are for what has historically been a late night shopping event. Tavistock doesn't really do late night shopping in any other sense of the word. It's always on Dickensian Evening. So, you know, it was quite interesting to hear feedback from some businesses who said it was a really great evening.
So late night shopping may be something you do separate to Dickensian?
Yeah, it's something we're going to look at this year. You know, obviously Christmas markets are really popular. We just have to figure out if that's the right thing for Tavistock, because we have tried late night shopping in the past and it's a tricky one, really. But, you know, that's on my radar. I need to sort of speak to all the businesses. It's business led, like I said, so it's their money that pays for this evening. So I have to make sure that we do what they want us to do.
So you've told us what money comes into to Tavistock. Now, potentially, there's a lot more that's going to come into Okehampton, isn't there? I think we're talking £130,000 a year. Now, that's a lot more. So do you think you can achieve more?
So it's a lot more, actually. Although there are fewer levy payers in the Okehampton, Bibb, catchment area, levy payers, some of them are bigger because we've included the industrial estates. So the catchment area for the Bid in Okehampton is a lot bigger. And you have some really big businesses in there who have supported it. So the income is much greater. So a lot more can be achieved with money like that. Absolutely. You know, that's a really good income for a town like Okehampton.
Jenna Sanders there, excited to bring West Devon's second main town on board the Bid train. Let's get back to devolution, shall we, Guy? What have you got for us now?
I suspect this is going to be a recurring theme on Devoncast. It will be back to devolution every now and then on Devoncast. Well, yesterday, as I said, I was standing out in the rain at Castle Circus in Torquay with our Police and Crime Commissioner, Alison Hernandez. The occasion was the launch of her five-year police and crime plan, which will come before the police panel meeting, which I believe you're covering this week, Ali.
I am. Tomorrow is the day.
She says police must be relentless in the fight against crime, and she's making priorities of theft, alcohol-related offences and rural challenges. She was asked what was in the plan.
Well, I think what's been really interesting is this is my third police and crime plan that I'm producing now. And it's the thing that actually the chief constable has to have regard to in terms of policing. So it's all the things that the public tell me they want to see improvements in. So I'm only putting things in there that need a step change or something different. And there's some complete alterations in this one from the previous iteration. So we've got theft in here, which we didn't have before. So there hasn't been a focus on shoplifting and burglary. So those two things have been added into the plan. But also I'm going to have a focus on alcohol this term of office. As we've all seen it in our towns and cities. We've got street drinking, alcoholics. We've got bars and pubs open till late. We've got some real challenges because we know that most domestic violence happens linked to alcohol and drugs. So we want to really try and push that down and do something different this time. But it's still got in there violence that still needs to be addressed. It's still also got antisocial behaviour. And I think for me, one of the biggest areas that I'm really trying to focus on in here is focusing on rural communities in our homes and also on our roads. So we're looking at it from a range of different aspects of the things we need to do against those priorities.
Shoplifting will be one of the target areas for police in the coming years, with local businesses having said in the past that they feel no one's listening to them.
I feel really sorry for people who are trying to run a business. They're coming in every day. They want to feel excited about coming to work, don't they? You know, everyone doesn't like getting up in the morning. And the last thing you want to do is see your own products being lifted from your shop and feeling like nothing's going to happen about that. One of the biggest things that I'm taking to in putting into the budget this year, and we're going to trial it in Torquay, is a proper reporting system for shopkeepers to be able to put the package together of what's happened in their shop and send it straight through to the police. So the police have basically had all the work done for them. So we're going to trial that here. So let's hope the budget goes through at Police and Crime Panel.
But even if the new reporting systems work perfectly, will shop owners receive the response they've been crying out for?
Well, what I will say is I can't guarantee that you report one isolated shoplifting incident that you're going to get a gold service of a police officer's going to turn up, take the CCTV. But I will tell you, if you got assaulted or anybody got injured during that incident, they will take that very seriously, an isolated incident. If you're a shopkeeper who has multiple shoplifting that's happening daily, then there's often a really good relationship with the local policing team so that they can actually target those prolific individuals, because it's the same people doing it multiple times. It's not lots of new individuals. So they can actually target those people. The bit I'm worried about, though, is with the courts, we have got challenges. If you shoplift, you might only get a few weeks in prison. But while it's respite for the community because you're not there committing that crime, there also isn't enough time to actually deal with the issues that that individual has to stop them doing it again when they come out. So we've got to fix that. We've got to do something different with people who are prolific shoplifters.
The five-year plan is ambitious and far-reaching. Is there enough money in the kitty to pay for it?
Well, we're actually in one of the better positions as a police force throughout the whole country. And that's largely because we've done really good, prudent financial management, and I am responsible for the money. But also, we have had the second homes bonus, which us and Cumbria in particular benefit greatly from, which is where people are paying double their council tax. So thank you to those second homeowners, because it's actually alleviating some of the pressures of the cost increase in policing. But what I will say, a lot of the ways to fix the problems that we've got in the plan are not financial issues. They are a lack of ideas, a lack of taking risk on radical ideas. And I think that's where we need to go in this next term of office. I've got in here, I want some to test some radical ideas to challenge domestic violence and sexual violence, because it's constantly on the increase and we don't seem to be able to stem the flow. So we're going to have to do something different, I believe.
And here we go back to devolution as promised. All these bold plans for policing in the next 5 years remain very uncertain as the government moves forward with the plans in its white paper. That says that an elected mayor, such as the one who might end up taking charge of a great sprawling strategic authority covering Devon and Cornwall, could also be the police and crime commissioner, or vice versa.
I think there's a few things there. I think in the southwest generally, we've got some challenges with boundaries that don't match up. So police, fire and local authority, those are that you want all three to have the sweet spot, I think, as an elected mayor, because you can really make some inroads on efficiencies. But we don't seem to match anywhere that would fit that with the size of the geography that the government wants for a mayoral authority. Devon and Cornwall are trying to go. I think Devon want the mayor, Cornwall doesn't. Isles of Scilly definitely don't. And all I'll say is I cover Devon, Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly. So if there is a mayoral authority, they'll need to take the Isles of Scilly to take policing.
And if there's an election for a mayor, is that a role that you think you could do?
I think I've already started to do that in my role as Police and Crime Commissioner. I've got prisoners building homes for the homeless that are modular homes that are net zero. I'm delivering on the things that councils say that they profess are important, but I'm actually giving them solutions to that. We've also got the tri-service safety officers, which is police, fire and ambulance, even though we don't have coterminous boundaries, where we can show you an efficiency on the front line to keep our communities safe. Born in Cornwall, but we are going to take it around the country. And I've already spoken to the policing minister about whether the neighbourhood policing grant that they've given us can include tri-service safety officers.
So, Ali, what do you think? Might we have been talking there to Alison Hernandez, the prospective first elected mayor of Devonwall? Wait and see, she said. She was quite non-committal, but she did say wait and see.
Well, I think there's every chance, isn't there? You know, she's got the credentials, and she's had to take a lot of flack over the years, and certainly a directed elected mayor would have to do that. But I think, you know, if the role of the PCC does go under that remit, then, you know, she's going to be out of a job, isn't she, if she isn't the mayor. So
it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When they were first talking about having an elected mayor for Devon or Devon and Cornwall, I was thinking idly about who might be the candidates for it. And to be honest, she was one of the first people I thought of because of the role that she's doing now, which covers the two counties. But what you've got to get to the bottom of constantly is the fact that not all of the authorities involved in this devolution actually want it. Cornwall does not want to be a part of an authority with Devon, and neither do the Isles of Scilly. There are some hurdles to overcome, aren't there?
Yeah, there is. Cornwall's standing strong, we know that, but you know, it may be that they have to come under that overarching authority and not be on their own, because you know there is a lot of support for that at the moment, obviously not Cornwall but everywhere else is. So an interesting one, really. Cornwall on its own, I don't know. It's been trying for independence for years, hasn't it?
It has.
But I don't know. I mean, I'm a Cornish lass myself, but, you know, I'm not sure it's the right thing.
Don't let them hear you say that. It's quite recently the government was talking about, and they were starting to develop the possibility that Cornwall would be on its own, would have devolved powers and would sit on the same Council of Regions as Wales and Scotland, but it just seems as if this new proposal, the new white paper, might just supersede that.
I think so. I mean, Cornwall is a unitary anyway. It's been a unitary for years, hasn't it? So it's it'll still be in control of its local services. But you know, there's a lot of people that are saying having a southwest regional authority is really going to give the area some weight and a voice that it doesn't have. And you know, there are some similarities, aren't there, between Cornwall and Devon. So it's a tricky one, but it will be interesting to see what happens on that score. But Cornwall aren't going to give up without a fight, that's for sure.
They're not. But could we be the southwestern powerhouse? Who knows?
Yeah, that might be a way forward. Anyway, thank you for listening today. That was Devoncast for you, your weekly podcast rounding up all the county's crucial stories. Thanks for listening, whatever you're doing while you're listening. And don't forget to subscribe. And remember, you can find us on Devoncast Radio on DAB across most of the county. We'll be back next week.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.